Right, hello everybody. Welcome back to the final episode of the Scared to Death podcast for the fall semester. My name is Peter Montwell, and I am a master's student under Dr. Lindsay Harville Bowman here at JMU. And today we have two guests. First, the intellectual owner of the Scared to Death podcast, Dr. Lindsay Harville Bowman herself, and Dr. Ken Critchfield, the director of the PsyD program at Yeshiva University. So Lindsay and Ken, feel free to introduce yourselves.
Ken, you want to go ahead?
Okay, why not? Thanks, Peter and Lindsay. Thank you both for having this occasion. I am currently, I'm an associate professor and a program director of the clinical PsyD program at the Firkhouse School of Psychology at Yeshiva University. And I have been in this role only a few months. Before this, I was at James Madison University in a similar role as the program director of their PsyD program. And that's where Lindsay and I started talking. And my piece of this conversation has to do with a thing called interpersonal reconstructive therapy that I think I can describe a little bit later on. But that is me in a nutshell, is that I am a psychotherapist interested in this particular approach to therapy, and I do a fair amount of training and research and also practice using this model. And a lot of the practice work that I do and the research, frankly, has focused around suicidal people who also have a lot of other problems, and suicide is one facet of it.
All right, I am Lindsay Harville Bowman, and I guess the intellectual owner, that was very fancy the way you said that, Peter. I'm an associate professor here at James Madison in the School of Communication Studies and the director of the Terror Management Lab and the chair of the Institutional Review Board. My research focuses around existential psychology and terror management theory, as well as I'm interdisciplinary, so I also dabble in political communication and weave that in through existential concerns and thoughts about our own death.
All right, awesome. Well, thank you both for taking the time out of your day to join me today. And so for our first question, this is for Ken, and you just mentioned your work with interpersonal reconstructive therapy, otherwise known as IRT. And I just wanted to know if you could introduce that to listeners who may not know, and also what fascinates you about IRT.
Yeah, well, thank you. Basically, it is an approach to psychotherapy developed by Lorna Smith Benjamin, who has been my friend and colleague for many years. I first met her when I was an undergraduate still at the University of Utah, where she taught most of the latter part of her career. And the approach is what's called an integrative approach. So folks who know something about psychodynamic or cognitive behavioral therapies or humanistic therapies, this is an approach that blends together elements of those into an integrative whole. And it does it in a particular way that Dr. Benjamin Lorna describes as really encapsulating a lot of the clinical wisdom that has long been in the field of clinical psychology, or at least psychotherapy practice. And the core of it, without getting into every detail, the core of it is that a lot of what we call psychopathology is traceable to problematic ways of being in relation to other people and also in relationship to the self or the identity. Mm-hmm. And that those problematic ways of being can be described in terms of patterns of relating. And those patterns in turn are learned, or they make sense in light of the learning history with close attachment figures. So people who have been close to the heart, this usually includes parents, but as in John Bowlby's attachment theory, but it also includes pretty much anyone who's gotten close to the heart along the life's journey. And the general idea is that we come to know ourselves and how the world works through our interactions with important other people. We essentially internalize them and their rules and values for us and play out those patterns, especially for navigating safety and threat in what we perceive of the world around us. And so the therapy approach basically is about helping people learn what their patterns are and where they come from in these terms I've just described, and also what purposes they serve in the present. Usually the purpose they serve in the present is to keep us feeling close and connected with our loved ones. And that's a normal human thing. Where it relates to psychopathology is when the lessons that were learned in those close relationships are problematic in some way that's maladaptive now in adulthood. And this can include some pretty extreme states, including, basically if I felt rejected or attacked in my close relationships growing up, then if I am now attacking and rejecting myself, including to the point of suicide, that the repetition of that pattern suggests there's a link, and that by wanting to kill myself, for example, I'm drawing close to my attachment figures by replaying that pattern. So when the patterns are healthy and adaptive, the life goes well. And when the patterns are maladaptive, there's a need to look at it, understand what that's about, and try to get some, perspective and ability to choose ultimately a different way. And that can entail grief and coming to terms with a lot of things in a long-term therapy process. And the therapy itself provides an individualized kind of scaffolding to learn what has been going on in a particular patient's life, and then to select interventions that are going to be kind of tailor-made to what their life has contained. That's the whole thing in a nutshell, about as quickly as I can tell the story. And what fascinates me about it, there's a lot of things that fascinate me about it. I think the core of it is something that I find very redemptive about human nature, that everything is essentially everything, meaning in my business, the mental health problems, psychiatric diagnoses are often a product of a love story that unfortunately has gone very wrong, but it's a love story nonetheless. And that I find compelling, as opposed to points of view that basically say there's, you know, some inherent destructive element within us that drives pathology.
So you mentioned in that, just talking about like how it heavily like is based in people's own experiences from like their past and how they're connecting that to their present. Mm-hmm. Do you have any, like, how do you find this connects to terror management theory?
Oh, well, that's itself a fascinating question. And it's what I have loved about meeting Lindsay. There's a lot of things I love about meeting Lindsay, but this was the initial like intellectual spark, I think, between us, as I perceived it, because I didn't know a whole lot about terror management theory before meeting Lindsay. I knew it kind of at a distance in the literature. And I was brought on board basically to be a clinician on the research project who could sort of help mitigate problems if people got stirred up or became suicidal as a result of talking about their history with it in a study of undergraduates we were doing originally. And, you know, there's a number of existential concerns that come up, even from the IRT point of view, that relate to attachment and this idea that we make meaning of our lives and of even of our deaths through this lens of relatedness with other people. And then I think the way at least I understand terror management theory is that there's sort of a story told from the other direction, which is, there's a powerful impact of death salience that's been demonstrated many times in the literature. And the idea is that we so don't want to go down the road of an actual ending to our existence that we will sort of double down on our investments in communities and values and relationships. And so I think that the two things kind of interface at the level of the important role that meaning and relatedness has. That is certainly stimulated by awareness of death itself. And then the question also comes up with this is, how can death itself in the form of suicide be so compelling for people? And that's the part where IRT comes in to say, well, it's not, suicide is a problem that's not absent of relatedness. And many times people are trying to solve a problem of relatedness as opposed to embracing an end of to existence per se. At least that's how I'm thinking of it today.
It's very interesting. And just to shift gears real quick, because we'll jump back onto the connection to IRT and TMT in a little bit. But Lindsay, so you've been working with TMT a lot longer than Ken has, and in many different settings, including a political and clinical settings. Have you found any differences to your approach and how you've worked with it, or how you've been able to make it into an interdisciplinary sort of field?
I get less sleep with the clinical side. Obviously, from a risk perspective, I don't know that Ken loses as much sleep as me because that is his specialty, but I definitely will think about these clients, you know, after, and I'm sure Ken does as well. But I want to also second what Ken said about these stories being absolutely beautiful and a love story. And I think if there's anything, you know, it's dark and it's deep and it's heart-wrenching, but from an existential meaning perspective, it's always such a beautiful thing to speak to clients and to obviously extend theory, but just get a piece of their life. Obviously, you know, I dabble in clinical settings. Thanks to Ken, who enables me to do that. I would not be able to do this without him. And so what was cool about that is we met because of this one study, and what ended up is several decades of research that we've already planned out and a great friendship. And so I'm super glad that I was able to just stumble into his office, and he was willing to take a chance and work with someone he had literally just met. And someone who is interdisciplinary, right? And mm-hmm. So I think terror management theory and interpersonal reconstructive therapy, you know, they go across disciplines, right? I mean, we've been talking about attachment mm-hmm. in communication for some time, right? And so a lot of what Ken was doing is very familiar to me in interpersonal communication, and terror management theory obviously spans multiple disciplines as well, not only in psych and comm, but in a lot of others. I think that answered your question.
Yeah. So both of you just mentioned meeting each other through like just doing one project together. Would you all mind to share the story of how that happened and any all the different projects you both have done together since?
Yeah, sure. And correct me if I have any of these these facts wrong. I may have romanticized it in my mind. I initially had this idea of, okay, how do people who experience suicidal ideation, how are they getting around that desire to survive, right? That Darwin speaks of and that we have all focused on and that terror management theory focuses on, right? If we're not afraid to die, then we have a problem in regards to my research and a whole bunch of other scholars' research. So I was wondering how, from a theoretical perspective, you know, what was a mechanism that people were using that were experiencing suicidal ideation that got around that anxiety and being so willing to take their own lives? As I started to think of this study, I started talking to a lot of people at James Madison. I spoke to legal, I spoke to risk management, I spoke to our provost, I spoke to Dean Lovell in CHBS, I spoke to a lot of people and told them kind of what I was thinking of doing. And it was Provost Coltman that told me, I would feel a lot better if you had a licensed psychologist, you know, with you. And so I started asking around in psychology of kind of who did this. And for our listeners that aren't aware, James Madison has two psych departments, the Department of Psychology, as well as the Department of Graduate Psychology. And so I was looking in both of those, and someone, and I cannot remember who, mentioned Ken, and I emailed him out of the blue and randomly ended up in his office one cloudy afternoon. And we had a chat, and it was, you know, instant kind of light bulb moments for both of us that our work could overlap and did overlap. And I correct me if I'm wrong, Ken, but I remember you being surprised that we were doing some of that work in communication, but obviously not from a clinical perspective. And yeah, I was grateful for Ken to work with us. And then it went into future research that we have planned, as well as a great friendship between our families and ourselves, which is great. So we have some work planned. We're currently working on our grant-funded research, looking at people who have an attempt in their background. And we plan on embarking on suicidality within Indigenous communities in the future. Ken, did I leave anything out?
No, I don't think so. I mean, you were on quite an odyssey before I met you, you know, within, you know, just trying to navigate how much is involved with, you know, sensitivity and risk management within a college population. And I think in some ways that speaks to both just a number of issues that relate to suicidality, including the perception of it as that thinking about one's own death is somehow rare and dangerous to talk about. And I think that a couple of the things that our research ended up showing, in some ways just implicitly, is that there, you know, we had no problem accruing people to that study. As I understand, we were turning people away because there's not only, you know, a fairly high percentage of people who have suicidal, you know, thoughts of one kind or another, but that talking about it is actually, no surprise to me as a therapist, but talking about it is actually helpful and grounding, and it connects people, and it actually reduces risk on average. Now, of course, we were also sensitive to the need to refer people to the counseling center or other resources if our conversations didn't go that way. But by and large, it was a good thing to do. And it's also, of course, a good thing to be aligned with your institution and understand that the risks that you're undertaking on their behalf or under their watch. But in some ways, that fear of other people's suicidality is something that maybe keeps us culturally from talking about it as much as we should. And so anyway, that getting back to when Lindsay and I first met, the piece that she noted I was surprised about is I sort of dimly knew it, but didn't really think about it, is that the psychotherapy process research that I do is basically about, you know, looking at patterns of interpersonal behavior and even mutual influence at kind of a moment by moment, statement by statement level. And that's an exercise in analysis of communication. And so when Lindsay and I started talking and I was explaining something about the way we measure patterns in IRT using a thing called the structural analysis of social behavior, also developed by Lorna Benjamin, it basically aligned, you know, with paradigms in the field of communications. So, you know, we got sensitized to the fact that it was interdisciplinary work in some respects, but in other respects, it was, you know, we were both existing within the Venn diagram of the overlap of those fields. And it didn't really seem like we had to create bridges. It was more like we just had to recognize we were standing in very similar space already. At least that's how I experienced that piece.
Yeah, absolutely. I did as well. And I think as we have become more known at James Madison for doing this research together, I think it not only shows, yes, it's interdisciplinary between psych and communication, but it's also interdisciplinary with the subdisciplines within psychology as well. And you know, I think we're really lucky at James Madison that the administration has been very supportive of our work, and especially both the deans, Robert Aguirre, who is our Dean of College of Arts and Letters, as well as Sharon Lovell, who's the Dean of CHBS. Both deans have been very, very supportive, as well as Provost Coleman talking about our work. So
they've shown due concern and also a really lovely openness.
Yes.
Awesome. And just for some context for the listeners, also myself, what year did you all first meet?
Oh my gosh.
I was trying to think of that too. I couldn't remember.
let's see. Time stands still.
2017?
No. Let's see. Yeah, it may have been 2016 or 2017. Had my first book come out yet? That's what I'm trying to remember. I think let's go with 2017. That feels good. It was the summer. I remember it was the summer and it was cloudy, but that's all I've got.
There's some documentation somewhere. We don't know where it is. And we're not aging either.
This just shows, I mean, you guys have been working on this for a very long time. As long as I've been at JMU, that's really awesome. Do you have all any next steps for your partnership in these studies?
Yeah, well, we are going to complete our grant that we have from the Society for Personality and Social Psychology. We're going to finish that in the spring with clients who are who have a history of suicidal ideation, who have made an attempt in the past and survived, obviously, and are currently in therapy. And then we have plans to work on a grant looking at suicidality with Indigenous communities. And I feel sometimes random things come up as well, that we were working on a journal article for a clinical psych journal. We've got, yeah, what else do we have, Ken? I think that's it.
That's plenty.
It is plenty. the Indigenous grant will take us, that's 5 to 10 years of work.
And publishing bits and pieces of that along the way is actually, you know, in some ways I think science gets talked about like publishing is some sort of an after the fact thing. You find something in science and then you send it out the door. And I find that at least with this kind of work, it's part of the discovery process itself. So that the article that Lindsay just mentioned for the clinical journal is basically pulling together a few case examples. And the way we're structuring this one is it's some examples of clinical narratives that I've previously published, but it's like revisiting them with a terror management theory and an existential lens in particular to kind of see what was already there that we didn't recognize on these themes. And that kind of exercise, at least for me as a clinician, helps deepen my sensitivity and awareness to what's going on in the therapy room. So there's this like lovely learning process. I feel quite happy and privileged with this career path I'm on.
Yeah, I agree. It's great. I'm really looking forward to that piece. That's going to be good.
Yep. And it's definitely on my radar. We've got a deadline coming up quick on that one.
Yes, we do.
Well, thank you for sharing a little bit about your relationship and what work you all have done together. Just to switch gears a little bit, I wanted to see if you all had anything sort of in a more general scale, just like what would be the next step of progress for both, I guess, clinicians and researchers today? Because I mean, there's obviously been a lot of progress, I think, since forever, with especially this new trend of open research. So I just wanted to see if you all had any thoughts or opinions on open research or on the next step of progress, whatever you would like to share.
Well, can you, Peter, can you say a little bit about what open research is and how you think that question works here?
Yeah, so open research, from my understanding, is the effort for researchers to try to build better, I guess I want to say barricades, but between good research and bad research, and definitely helping people to reproduce and replicate different studies by having all the different materials and resources listed out clearly for other people to observe and potentially use, as well as their results, allowing other people to perform their own analyses. If I missed something, please correct me. But yeah, I just wanted to see if either of you had any thoughts.
No, I think that's a good definition. You know, I think from a social psychology perspective, you know, open science is fantastic. I am a huge fan of open science. I think the more transparent we can be about our research and our data analysis procedures can only strengthen science and strengthen the results. I'm curious to hear about Ken's perspective on this, because from a clinical side of things, where you have HIPAA to worry about, I wonder, and especially with our suicide research, it's qualitative, sort of. I mean, we have quantitative aspects, but we're doing clinical interviews in clinical settings. So I wonder, Ken, what are your thoughts on that? Because, you know, it makes me a bit twitchy when I think about it from a clinical psych perspective.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's tricky. I really like the view of science as humankind's project, and so the more that we can share and be transparent together, the more we can facilitate access to knowledge and also verification of what's there. Much of what I study, at least in clinical psychotherapy, is, you know, protected by rules about medical records, and folks, of course, can sign releases over into research archives and so on. But there's a pretty strong ethic in clinical research about protecting the confidentiality of the people who contribute their information, because the information is usually very intimately linked with their identities, the people they know and care about, the confidences that they place in their therapists and their, you know, qualitative interviewers. So to put the kind of data I study out in some kind of format without gatekeeping would basically be unethical in the sense of violating the contracts that and the consents that people provide come into the research project. Having said that, that doesn't mean I would dismiss open research and open science entirely. It's just that there will have to be some very, very careful attention provided to those kinds of things. So, you know, at this point, if someone is a graduate student who comes to study with me, then, you know, I make sure they have the requisite training and protections and bring them into the world of looking at the data. Similarly with colleagues who are interested, if someone reaches out to me, we can work out potentially, for at least for some parts of the data, ways to collaborate and look together. But it's really tricky. And I think there's some other issues as well about intellectual property ownership. When I don't fully have the ownership myself, I have often an obligation to protect the ownership rights of someone who's developed a particular test or measure, or the institution I'm working for when it gets developed, if it's something I develop. It's a landscape that is complex because there are multiple embedded systems and interests involved. So that's kind of my take on it. It's not an either or. It's like every annoying clinical psychologist you'll ever talk to. It's like an it depends. Let's talk about it kind of a thing. Let's do some ethical decision making that will be very slow and involve lots of people.
Interesting. I'd been surrounded by a bunch of experimental psych people, so I haven't really heard much from the clinical side. So that's interesting. I didn't think of the problem with HIPAA.
I don't know how you do it from a clinical perspective, and I mean, obviously as an IRB chair, I'm sitting here thinking, I don't know how you do it.
There are some forms of it that can't be done.
Yeah.
At least not the way the current regulatory structures are. Maybe you could go to a different part of the world and do the same thing in a different way. But I mean, that's part of it is it's a question about values and the political and community structures that are centered around those values. And I think that open research is a great values-based stance that fights against the kind of intellectual property owning of everything, including, you know, the human genome or access to water rights under someone's land. Like, I think that there's definitely too much in our society that's destructive about ownership and how that accumulates power. And science and its products are a type of power. And I think that we need to think really globally and systemically about what it means when we make our different choices. Are we protecting others' rights? Are we protecting our own selfish interests? What are we doing? And I think that that is the worthy conversation no matter what.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, awesome. Thank you for sharing your input on that. We're running a little short on time. So I'm going to ask our last question now. It could be the hardest one of the day. And it's just, what are your spirit animals and why do you think that?
Ken knows exactly what I'm gonna say.
Do you
need a second to think, or do you have one? Because I don't think I know this answer for you.
I'm not sure I know the answer myself. I'll have to think on it.
All right. Well, mine is the emu.
Mm.
And mainly it's gonna terrify people about me. They are just incredibly awkward creatures. they're awkward, but they also could kill you too. I don't know if that's something I should say on an international podcast, but here we are. Peter, please don't send the police to my house later. I would like to also say I am not killing people, but I think emus are cute, and I'm not saying I'm cute, but I'm saying, like, you know, pretty, they're okay looking birds. But they're awkward and they could kill you. Not quite to the cassowary level, but but you know, I do. Virginia has a safari not too far, like an hour south of where we're at in Harrisonburg, and I like to go there. It's filled full of wild emus that you can drive through and feed, and I like the feeling that they could kill me at any point.
Sounds pretty proper for a death researcher.
Yeah, I'm super curious about Ken's animal.
Oh, I've been here sitting and thinking, and different ideas come to mind, but it's nothing is settling. This is why I don't have any tattoos. It's like I can't commit to anything like this. But now I've told the world I have no tattoos. Okay. One answer is my daughter and whatever animal she is being on a given day. And she has been long turning into a cat, she tells me. I can't see it from the outside because she's turning first from the inside into a cat, and then it will start to manifest outwardly. So something feline definitely has to be in the spirit animal realm here for me. And then that didn't seem entirely satisfying. So the only other thing that comes to mind are pigeons, because that's what I'm seeing a lot of here in the Bronx when I walk around. And again,
I feel like the
no particular reason for that. What was that?
I said, I feel like the feline fits you, you know?
Oh, does it?
You're very quiet.
Prefers to be basking in a window somewhere.
Yeah, you do enjoy the sunlight. You're skeptical, as we all should be. I am not. When emus are not skeptical, they'll walk right up to you, unfortunately, but they can kill you. So.
Well, yeah, and they will take that bucket of feed right out of your hand.
Yeah.
I've been to that safari park.
For those of us that are in Virginia, you should definitely go see the safari park.
It's right by the natural bridge.
It is.
So, okay, we'll settle on a cat for me. I'll start knocking things off of countertops just to make that work.
That is the one quality I have not seen yet, but I look forward to seeing it at some point.
All right, well, I want to thank you both for sharing your animals and joining me on the podcast today. It was awesome to hear you both talk. And and I want to thank you, the audience, for listening this semester. It's been a fun first round of podcasts, and we're very excited to do this again next year. So we'll see you all in 2022. Ken or Lindsay, do you have any final words for the audience?
No, thank you, Peter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the final thought is be good to your people. And thank you, Peter.
Thank you both. And thank you all for listening. Have a great rest of your year, and happy holidays.
Happy holidays. Thank you.